again. But we remember the dragon from the Silmarillion that we talked about in the dragon special who battled Turin?
Right.
What was his name?
I don't remember. I'm sorry.
Right, so you don't
remember. No, I remember what he did, though. I remember that he really took him for a loop. Like he.
Right. Well, so that was Glaurung. And
Glaurung, originally, that's right. See, yeah. Now it all comes back to me.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Okay.
His name's
Glaurung. Okay, yeah, edit that. Maybe if I'm feeling generous tomorrow when I edit this, if you say, oh yeah, it's Glaurung.
Oh yeah, it's Glaurung.
Maybe I'll edit out all the other stuff.
I'm Clifford.
Sweet. Clifford, we're back for another one.
We are indeed. Ooh. This is episode 15 of the Talkin' Tolkien podcast. Today, we bring you The Gathering of the Clouds from The Hobbit.
Is it Gathering of the Clouds or Gathering of Clouds?
Oh, my apologies. I might have misread that.
Well, no, I'm asking. I don't actually
know. I think it's The Gathering of the Clouds.
Oh. All right. Well, we'll come back to that then. All right. How you been?
Been pretty good. Like I was saying, I just did a long run the other day in preparation for some marathon training, or at marathon training in preparation for a marathon, I should say. But other than that, staying busy. How about you, Patrick?
Trying to get back into shape with the cycling, but
cool.
I don't remember how to ride up, or my body doesn't remember how to ride up mountains anymore. Like, I went out to a couple and just got utterly dropped by the guys I was riding with. I was high-key embarrassed.
I normally try to bike faster than everyone else on the bike commute.
Yeah.
All the other people around me. And I got totally crushed in both on my commute to work and my commute home today. One by just a guy who just blew past me. And then on the way home, a favor biker with one of those motorized wheels.
Oh, yeah.
He just sailed uphill next to me and then passed me. It's really frustrating.
You should do repeats on that one tough hill that's out there. What's that one called?
Oh yeah, Mount Bonnell.
Yeah,
that's brutal.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That's like I might as well just be lifting weights with my legs.
Yeah, 20 times up that thing.
Maybe. All right. I'm doing some cycling training.
All right, okay, let's go. Cliff Stones.
Okay, so. This is a big chapter. If you remember, at the very end of the last chapter, Bard slayed Smaug over the town, Lake Town, Esgaroth. And now we return to the dwarves, who have been hiding out in their cave/guard station. They see no sign of the dragon, but all the birds of the land are out and about. Ravens, thrushes, vultures. The dwarves and Bilbo are perplexed but wary. The thrush, who we know by now, lands near their camp to share some news, but unfortunately the company can't understand the bird. The thrush, however, returns with Roak, son of Kark, a great old raven that Balin knew when he was a youth at the Lonely Mountain. The birds share that the dragon is dead, which leads to some celebration, but also that elves and men are mustering forces and desire some treasure. Thorin gruffly thanks them for their information, but ignores their plea for peace. He sends word to his cousin Dane in the Iron Hills, who can muster a dwarf army. The group, along with a glum Bilbo, returns to the main cavern, where they quickly ensure that all the back doors to the cabin have been blocked, and they set about fortifying the main door for battle. Eventually, the men and elves arrive in their host and make camp in front of the mountain, where they are surprised to find the door blocked and prepared for a siege. Bard, who, if you remember, is the one who shot the dragon, leads a parley group to speak with Thorin and lays out his desires and demands. Some of the treasure of the mountain is from Dale, stolen by Smaug, and Bard is the heir to Dale. Bard killed the dragon, which permitted the dwarves to regain the treasure, and the town of Esgaroth is mostly destroyed, unintentionally the fault of the dwarves, who were given aid and supplies by the men of Esgaroth in a time of need. Thorin basically tells them to mind their own business. He will repay exactly the value of the supplies they were lent, and nothing more, and will speak no more to anyone prepared for battle. In response, the men and the elves declare the mountain under siege. Thorin's anger during all of this makes some of the younger dwarves nervous, not to mention Bilbo, who's quite concerned at the violent turn things have taken.
Yeah, so Thorin's everybody's favorite character now, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, my first big question for this episode is, how hard are we going to be on Thorin?
Yeah.
It seems like it kind of comes down to, is he just being a little bit unreasonable, or is he completely throwing off any resolution to this story and being a total... Well, we're not supposed to swear on this show, right?
Yeah.
All right, so what were your thoughts on this episode, Patrick?
I thought it was interesting. It seems like... Yeah, I mean, you know, first read through, you think it'd be over once the dragon was dead, but not at all.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. This felt like, I don't know what the proper English term would be, but it felt like we were coming down from the climax a little bit, but quick U-turn, we're actually building back up to another climax.
Yeah.
So, let's jump into it.
All right.
First thing that came to mind... There's these talking birds. We've got the thrush, who we know about from before, because, just as a little recap for everyone, the thrush had overheard the dwarves and Bilbo talking back when they found the secret portal to the mountain. They overheard Bilbo telling the dwarves that he saw the soft spot on the dragon's chest after his conversation. And the thrush passed that information along to Bard, who happens to be able to understand the thrush, we learned last time. And then the dwarves can't understand the thrush, but the thrush can understand them and recognize that they knew Kark, this old raven of old, and the thrush brings his son. So what do we make of this?
I mean, I thought it was kind of cool. I think it's kind of weird. Why do we have to have two sets of birds? Why couldn't they just understand the thrush? But
that's a good question. The way I interpreted that was it felt a little bit like the thrush has something to do with like the inherent knowledge of the place that they are. Like it's kind of like almost like a spirit of the land.
Yeah.
Where it's listening and absorbing information, and Bard is of that place and very in tune. He's kind of tapped into that vein. And the dwarves, even though they have a claim to the mountain, have been gone for a long time and have kind of lost that connection.
Okay.
So I got the impression that maybe back in the day they would have been able to understand the thrush, but because they're like they're worldly now and disconnected from their place, they can't, and they have to bring the raven as a translator.
Yeah, but they can still understand the ravens. I mean, I feel like the same thing's kind of going on with them.
Well, basically what I'm getting at is what it drove home for me is that Bard is being made out to be a little bit superior to the dwarves in this category. Maybe not superior, but a little bit more wise.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, that's believable based on how the dwarves have acted, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Talking birds aside and who's understanding them, let's talk about the content of what they're saying.
Well, Roic came, and Balin that was real buds with his dad, I guess. I don't know about real buds, but like knew of his dad, met his dad.
Balin's the oldest of the dwarves, right?
I think Thorin's the oldest.
Oh, really? Okay. But he and Balin grew up together.
Yeah, and we know that those two are at the Lonely Mountain. Now, Dwalin is Balin's brother, but I don't know if he's there.
Well, anyways, Thorin and Balin are the oldest. They grew up at the Lonely Mountain, and Balin happened to have spent some time with Kark, who's the father of this raven that now shows up.
Yeah, and so then the raven was saying, well, he explained that Smaug's dead, right? Mm-hmm. All the dwarves were pumped, super pumped, like they were dancing around. And then what did he say? He said, you know, men and elves are coming because they want the treasure because they think it's undefended. And, you know, it'd be wise if you make peace with them. Bard's a good man. You should trust him.
Yeah. And also, I believe there's a little bit of we would request that things return to the harmony of old type thing.
Yeah.
Like, there was a time when this land was peaceful before the dragon showed up, and we want to see that return.
Yeah, and Roak would have heard that from his dad.
Which is interesting for me, because that's like a direct appeal. It's not just appealing to maybe the pathos of Durin, or Thorin, rather. Like, does he feel bad for the men and elves, or does he understand them? But it's also hearkening back to his own childhood, when times were good, and, like, hoping for a return to that.
I don't know if he was actually alive back then. Like, it might have just been the dad, and the dad had him after the dwarves left.
Oh, am I misspeaking? Thorin was never at the Lonely Mountain.
Oh, Thorin was. Oh, I thought you were talking about the birds.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. But I mean that the birds are appealing directly to Thorin's memory of that time. It's not only is it like an emotional plea, not only are they asking Thorin to empathize with the men and the elves and say, hey, they kind of have a point, but that aside, you must at least want to return to the peace that you remember as a child.
Yeah, and Thorin takes him up on the offer, right?
No, not quite. He basically...
What?
What do you mean?
I'm just kidding. Obviously he doesn't.
Okay. Yeah. I thought you confused me for a second there. Thorin basically tells him to shove it in a respectful way because they're the messenger and not the men and elves themselves, but tells the birds, thanks but no thanks, don't even think about it. And by the way, can you do me a favor and go tell my cousin to bring an army here? Which, I mean, first of all, what are you doing, Thorin? That seems like a terrible idea. You're ignoring the advice of the wise old birds, which just feels like the wrong thing to do. And then also you're asking a favor of them. And then the birds are so respectful that they fulfill his favor for
him. It didn't even seem like, when I read it, it didn't even seem like he was asking. He was just telling them, now, since you're the messengers, go do this too. Like, fly miles away to go get my cousin Dane and have him come here. Now...
directly against your advice.
Yeah. Just like, let's just note too, where have we already talked about Dane?
I believe he's come up in discussions of Moria.
Yeah, yeah. He was the guy that killed the pale orc at Moria. So Dane's hot stuff.
Okay. As a little recap, I remember from the movies which shall not be mentioned of The Hobbit, they kind of switched up the plot on us, and the pale orc played a pretty prominent role.
Yeah.
That is supposedly the same pale orc we're talking about, Azog.
Correct? Yeah.
Before the time frame of The Hobbit, Azog was around Moria leading a big group of orcs, and Dane went head-to-head with him. Something of the sort.
They had killed Thorin's grandpa. So then Thorin and his dad led all the dwarves, including his cousin Dane, to go fight a war against the goblins.
Right.
Yeah, and so that's how that came about.
Oh, and that's the battle that Thorin got his name Oakenshield from.
Yeah.
Okay.
We just said orc instead of goblin a couple times there.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry, crowd will explain in Lord of the Rings.
Okay. For now, we just know that they're the same thing.
Yeah, we should be calling them goblins right now.
Okay, noted.
Whoops. Yeah.
You know, the back of my Hobbit book says orcs.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is.
My back doesn't say anything.
Yeah, because you got the sweet old-fashioned leather copy. Anyways, so Dane's a big deal, and he hopefully is coming with an army of dwarves from Moria. Is that correct?
Right, yeah. No, not from Moria, from the Iron Hills.
Oh, from the Iron Hills, I'm sorry.
Much closer.
Somewhere nearby. So, Thorin's got war on his mind.
Well, Thorin's prepared to go to war to keep this treasure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And why do you think the birds just went along with him? Like, I mean, he completely did not take their advice and then ordered them to do stuff. Why did...
I mean, they listen. Even though it's probably disrespectful, to a certain extent, they are the messengers of the story, right?
Yeah.
Like, their reason to exist in the story is to pass messages along. So that does make a fair bit of sense. Also, the way it's been described with, like, all these birds flying around in the air all over the place, spreading the word is... You could kind of see it as, like, you're just adding information to the grapevine. So Thorin just mentions, I want Dane to come. Dane's coming with his army, yada yada. That is now in the grapevine that kind of spreads in all directions. So Dane hears that as well as everyone else. Is quite possibly another way to see it.
Okay.
Point being, I don't really know why they would do it on a personal level, but for the sake of the story, they're kind of there as the messengers.
Well, yeah. All
right. All right. Do you have a rebuttal to that?
No, I have no idea why they do it on a personal level.
Okay.
For the story, it's like, obviously, yeah, we need them to do it. Mm-hmm. Have things continue to move.
Mm-hmm.
If the dwarves
I was kind of hoping for or even expecting a little like passing remark like, well, don't say we didn't warn you type thing.
Yeah.
Or I don't want to be the one to say I told you so. So shall we return to Thorin?
Sure.
The thorn in my side.
that was weak.
Couldn't help myself. Thorin, though, is this entirely dragon sickness that we're watching him get totally corrupted?
Yeah. Yeah, it absolutely is.
Okay. Nothing more to it.
Yeah. I mean, well, they were making references about how a dwarf, like... You know, Bilbo underestimated how much they could lust after gold.
Right.
You know, if we want to slightly jump ahead here, if we want to go to the whole last line of the chapter,
uh-huh.
The last line was, the whole place stinks of dragon, and it makes me sick. You know, that's Bilbo talking there.
Right.
But it stinks of dragon because, well, Smaug's stench is still around because, you know, he's only been gone for maybe 2 weeks at this point. He's only been dead
right.
for 2 weeks.
Right.
But... Of course, you know, there's a new dragon in town, which is Thorin, you know?
Mm-hmm,
he's got the new dragon sickness, so, you know, he's basically replaced Smaug. I mean, he's a dwarf, so he's not scary looking and everything, but he's replaced Smaug.
Right. Despotic is a word that comes to mind. Where, not that he was totally democratic in the past, like asking the other dwarves for advice, but he's taken the reins in a whole new way at Thorin, I'm talking about. I should just clarify. Thorin's taken the reins in a whole new way here, where we hear throughout the chapter that other dwarves are hesitant about the way Thorin is speaking or behaving.
But most of them agree with him.
Perhaps. I guess so. They're wooed by him, but I think
and by the gold, it affects them too. Probably
particularly the younger dwarves. I think Keely and Feely get mentioned once or twice as being a lot more hesitant to join in with the dwarves in their anger.
Yeah.
That felt to me like a kind of a classic depiction of, on the one hand, like very specifically generation conflict as it relates to generations, a little bit like you might have in a Romeo and Juliet scenario where there's like an age-old rivalry and the young people don't really understand it, or it doesn't mean the same thing to them because they're from a different generation. Like, they don't feel the kind of the pain of old, or... You see that throughout stories, I think, throughout history, is, like, the... Like, this driving passion and anger for an older generation doesn't carry through to a younger generation because they haven't suffered through or experienced the same things.
Mm-hmm.
And taken more broadly, like, obviously there's a ton of stuff that older and younger generations disagree about because they just have different ways of looking at the world. But that felt like a very very relatable or kind of common theme that I saw with the dwarves there.
Yeah, and it's the same with Bilbo as the outsider. Like, he doesn't get it at all. Yeah, Feely and Keely, I mean, obviously, yeah, they're the young ones. But I thought it was kind of weird because they're... Do we know this? Well, they're like... They're Thorin's nephews. I don't know if we quite know that yet, but...
Okay.
So, like, so, you know, nephews.
I've gathered that that's about the age difference, but I don't know there's actual blood relation.
Yeah, and it's, like, it's not like they're second cousins like some of these guys are, or, like, unrelated, because, like, I think Bomber's unrelated to Thorin, but he just volunteered to go, basically. But Keely and Feely are his nephews, so, like, his sister's sons. And Thorin himself is never married, because I guess that's common with dwarves, but, yeah. Or for like, some of the dwarves.
For the kings.
Yeah, those two, though. I don't know. I feel like they would have been...
on Thorin's side by nature of their blood relation.
Yeah, just completely loyal, because he's just out of like, family duties, you know?
Yeah, I could see that. Once again, though, I come back to the... I mean, I don't have a good comparative example, but to me, that generational divide feels like a much stronger thing than any other force in some places. Like... you think of all the classic, like, going home for Thanksgiving and the disagreements between generations over how things should be or what things mean. That's, like, a classic trope, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, they also have the appeal that, well, it looks way more fun in the elves and men's camp than...
yeah, when the elves and men are playing songs and feasting, yeah. Clearly they're a little bit jealous.
Yeah.
But I do feel it was like it was kind of a simple, why can't we just get along, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you on all that. I just don't know what more to say, really, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thorin is being quite unreasonable.
Yeah. A couple other things, though, with this, though, with the dragon sickness. So, you know, dragon's dead. We thought the story would have been over by now, but no. Just because the dragon's dead doesn't mean, like, all this evil's gone and everything. You know, if anything, the dragon sickness is stronger now that the dragon's gone because anybody else can claim his gold.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think this kind of gets back to our dragon special, where, you know, we kind of ultimately concluded, and I think this reinforces our idea that for Tolkien, yeah, dragons were obviously evil characters always, but they were kind of just agents or mercenaries of evil as opposed to, like, the ultimate evil themselves, you know?
Right.
Like, so... because, yeah, this thing's dead.
Not necessarily a source.
Well, it's a source of evil, but it's not by no means the ultimate source. And
right. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because, I mean, yeah. I mean, this guy died and, you know, all the bad stuff of the story is just completely continuing. Like,
right.
No break whatsoever.
Right. There's no flames coming out of the sky, but that's about it.
Yeah, and then, you know, Thorin's basically, he's... well, he writes a song, which we'll talk about in a second, but that's basically, you know, that he writes a new song, and it's basically a prideful song on the old song that we've had since the first chapter.
The one they sang in Bilbo's house.
Yeah, and so, you know, he's still looking for the Arkenstone and all his gold, but then he's also taking measures of how much he's got of everything, and then he's counting down the days to how quick Dane could get there to defend it with his army. But, right. You know, the dwarf army's gonna come, and... since men and elves are camped outside, which, again, we'll also talk about that later.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the dwarf army somehow wins, then, you know, it's already winter, so they won't have any supplies to, like, get them through. So, you know, the whole army would just starve anyways.
Yeah. No, I mean, it sounds like a terrible situation all around. Like, clearly the only thing on Thorin's mind is
treasure. Yeah, terrible situation, and it is all Thorin's fault. All of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So this kind of takes a step back from the story a little bit. Bilbo's clearly playing a less significant role in this chapter than we've seen in the past. He certainly thought the story was going to end with the death of Smaug. Like, he was expecting to get to go home and everything was all good. And we, the audience, thought that as well. At least I did. And so I was thinking that that felt a little bit intentional, maybe. Like, Tolkien was intentionally casting Bilbo in with the spectators at this point in the story. Like he's becoming less of an active character and more of an observer in the way that we are, kind of watching all these other events unfold.
Well, Bilbo's job is kind of done, you know?
Yeah. So it was a peculiar thing that I didn't realize at first, but Bilbo really, like, he steps back.
Well, I mean, whether he wanted to, yeah. I mean, Thorin was taking the reins now, you know. Now,
certainly. I guess I mean to say, like, I see it from Tolkien's standpoint, like he has deliberately thrown Bilbo in with the audience.
Yeah, for this chapter.
Observing this
for story. This chapter at least. Yeah. And I mean, we'll get to this in a second when we talk about the conversation. But this chapter, it kind of goes back to the real old epic heroic stuff, which Bilbo's the modern character. This chapter, there's no place for that. I mean, right. This is the absolute high point of it not being that.
Right.
Yeah.
So you think in a sense, Bilbo being the modern character, being relatable to us, is kind of like the story is reverting to like an older epic narrative style, and therefore the modern character is kind of like witnessing this unfold rather than participating in a stranger modern incarnation.
Yeah, let's jump to the conversation. Forget the song. I mean, okay, the song. All I took away was, you know, it seemed like Thorin kind of wrote it on the spot to the same verses, and it was just the king's back under the mountain, and this time he's not leaving, no matter what foes come. And he didn't mention at all how the dragon was defeated. He just was like, yeah, dragon's done. So pumped, you know. All right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But anyways, so this negotiation thing. So they build up all these dwarves here from the birds that, okay, men and elves are going to come marching up here. So Thorin runs back with all the dwarves, and they build this wall, and, you know, they're super motivated because they want to guard all the treasure.
Yeah, yeah. They quickly explore the caverns, and they brush off their old tools and cut stones. Yeah,
quick note on that, too. We had said, like, two episodes ago, we were wondering how there were no other entrances to this mountain, but it sounded like Smaug knew about the other entrances and then destroyed them. He just never knew about the secret entrance. Or, you know, if you thought it was like a vent and he didn't care. Yeah. So
at this point, we know there are many entrances, but all of them have been blocked off by stone.
Right, yeah. And so then, anyways, the men and elves come marching up, and Thorin hails them. You know, we're already using the words like hail, you know, as opposed to just like greet or, you know, call out. Or I don't know, yeah. Right. So, and then they run away, but then, like, a day or a couple days later, I don't know. So sometime later, Bard and the Elf King come with a company of their men, and they hail Thorin. And then Thorin talks to him from the wall about what's the deal, like why are they there, what's going on. And so what? So I got like four things here. So Bard says, first thing, I killed the dragon, so I deserve something for it. Second thing, I'm the heir of Girion, who was Lord of Dale, and a lot of the treasure in there belonged to Dale, so we should have that part back at least, right? Smaug destroyed Lake Town, and these people are in desperate need of some sort of currency, probably to just buy goods, really.
Yeah, and rebuild and all that sort of thing.
Not to mention, they helped you out, so you owe them that. And then,
yeah, helped Thorin out when he had nothing, basically.
And the whole reason the dragon even attacked him was because you guys stirred it when you entered the mountain.
Right. So he said, I'm not blaming you because it was not your intention, but it is ultimately your fault that the dragon was out and about to destroy the town.
Yeah, so I got down here from notes from these books. So Thorin ignores the first one, which is Bard was the actual dragon slayer. He doesn't even acknowledge it. He refuses the second one, which is where Bard said, hey, part of the treasure was from Dale. The third one he agrees to, which is the compensation for the people of Lake Town because they helped him out, but that was about it. So that seems like a pretty measured, calculated, you know, probably get back exactly what they gave him, you know.
Yeah, he said that. He said, I'll give back that and not a loaf of bread more or something like that.
And then four, he doesn't care what Smaug did, which is like, you know, four was, well, the dragon only attacked because you guys provoked it. But he's just said, I don't care what Smaug did, you know, that was Smaug being Smaug. You know, he had already done enough evil deeds to us. I can't control what he does after that. So, what do you make of that?
I mean, it was very frustrating, I thought. He sounded like a lunatic. Bard was first of all very reasonable, but also presented himself well, presented himself in a humble way. He just came off like a very honorable, kind of unsung hero character. And like you said, Thorin didn't even acknowledge a few of his requests and was being stingy at best and like maniacal at worst.
Now, I thought Thorin brought up a fair point, though. He said, you know, if the men and elves had come walking up here and we had been dead, how mm-hmm. much of that treasure would have actually gotten to his cousin Dane, who was the heir? You know?
Right. So, true.
So it's like, all right, well, that's kind of a fair point, Thorin. Because, you know, the elf, that elven king, oh, no. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't be giving any of it up.
Yeah, Bart, he's got gold on his mind, too.
In, like, the about 10 pages that we've known Bard, he's... Uh-huh. I think everybody likes him, you know? I mean, yeah. he's referred to himself in the third person a couple times, but other than that
unforgivable offense.
Yeah. Other than that, he's been a pretty good guy and, you know, very reasonable and true, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Good. I like the bird's description, grim but true.
Yeah.
He's a good man, grim but true, something like that.
Yeah.
I thought that was good.
I think another thing that Thorin eventually said was, you know, why is the Elven King even here? You know, I'm not going to do any sort of negotiating with him here, and I'm not doing any sort of negotiating when you guys got swords out there. You know, I want to do this completely on my terms. That I actually kind of also think is fair. You know, if Thorin's
I thought there is some validity to say, like, that's kind of like a we don't pay ransom for hostages type thing. Like, I don't do diplomacy with people holding swords. Is like a, it's not a bad honorable rule to hold yourself to, but on the other hand, it's like they certainly weren't there like holding a sword to him. They're kind of going about the old ways of speaking properly before a battle, right?
Yeah, and I also just don't. I wouldn't actually get pissed at Thorin for saying, hey, I just don't even want to deal with the Elf King. Like, you got no business being here. Now, mm-hmm. the men should be negotiating, and then they should, like, give a share to the elves, because the elves helped them out. But, like,
yeah.
the elves...
And
the,
but the Bard did say that.
Yeah, the elves should not be at the bargaining table, in my opinion.
That makes sense to me. I think Bard did a good job of explaining, basically, we would basically barely be alive if it weren't for these elves.
And so what? Bard eventually asked for what? 1/12 of the treasure?
Mm-hmm.
That's a...
He's at 1/12 of the treasure as kind of a baseline, and then whatever Thorin's generosity might bequeath upon them as a reward on top of that, right?
Well, it seemed like Bard would go and use 1/12... He would get 1/12 of the treasure, and I think that was mostly like the dragon slaying fee. Not even, you know, like...
The Dale treasure.
Right, plus that, but I think... I don't know, I would... It seemed to be implying that they probably, you know, more than 1/12 of the treasure was from Dale. But, you know, Bard's actually being, like, pretty, very fair here. And
yeah, he's like,
I'll negotiate. Yeah. And
I'll take a hefty dragon slaying fee and use it to rebuild my town.
Right.
And I'll forgive the debt from Dale, basically.
Yeah, and so he was going to help use his profit to help the Lake Town people. And then he would also just ask and call upon Thorin to give more of his own part to the Lake Town people well, which is like, well, that's a fair deal, you know, like a matching gift kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, Thorin doesn't go for it.
He's like, no way.
And that's what?
I was going to say, at first, I momentarily forgot, because I know that the dwarf company is 13, but not 13, because Bilbo's the 14th.
Right.
I was confused for a second. I was like, 1/12, isn't that the same as Bilbo's share of the treasure, incidentally?
Well,
but Bilbo's 1/14, correct?
Yeah, Bilbo had said somewhere in the chapter, like, oh, I'll give up my share of the treasure to end this thing, you know? Which is, that's noble of Bilbo, but I guess, I don't know, yeah, Bard's asking for slightly more, but...
Mm-hmm. I was curious if you thought there's any significance to that 12th.
Mm-hmm.
Why 12th?
I don't know, 12 is just... That's another ancient heroic number, you know?
I guess so, yeah. 12 months type thing.
Yeah. I like all the language. I love the old heroic talk.
Yeah, so you were mentioning there's a direct shift. As soon as we kind of enter this battle siege parley situation, we revert to like older epic language, and even Thorin is speaking in complex tongue or complex verse, right?
Well, I mean, Thorin, that's not uncommon for him throughout this book, but yeah.
Right, but I thought he was like particularly Old English sounding.
Well, yeah, and it was he just sounds every, you know, to pick out like the four things that Bard was asking for, and then Thorin's response to all of them. It was like slightly tricky because it was pretty wordy, you know. And I mean that's intentional. Like that's a hallmark of the epic heroic talk there. And then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Bard just radiates it, you know, like we already mentioned, the third-person quality, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it's kings of old.
Yeah. I mean, like, the whole thing just reminds me of, if you want, like, movies, think, like, the Ten Commandments, like, the old 1950s, you know, movie where, so let it be written, so let it be done kind of stuff, you know?
Right.
Or, like, a less poetic Shakespeare, almost.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, it just seemed like this chapter was really laying on thick, and that's because, yeah, this was the highlight of the old times. You know, I mean, this whole book we've had the cross between modern stuff like with Bilbo versus the ancient heroic stuff. Like some of the modern examples was, well, Smaug was killed in kind of the modern way with like the discipline of the troops, and then
right,
but then there's older stuff like. Bjorn's one of those ancient guys. Every time Thorin says like anything important, is coming to like Lake Town, like that was pretty, you know, kingly and prophesized. And
So it is Tolkien trying to say something here by kind of going back to an epic, older epic narrative style here, or you don't think so?
Well, that's just what he was used to. That, I mean, that's what he liked to read. I mean, that was everything he liked to read, you know. If he had his way, he would just have everything be like that. But he wanted this story to be somewhat relatable, so he put in Bilbo.
So, you, in a very broad sense, and maybe I'm stepping back too far. You think it's kind of his passion and obsession is this old epic literature, and he sees it as his job, or just like what he happens to be doing is translating it into a more modern. Situation so it's relatable both for his kids and for people around him.
Yeah. I highly enjoy all the old talk. Like I think it's fun.
I'm thinking of various old kind of myths that I've read where there's a lot of unreasonable behavior by certain characters that drives me nuts.
Yeah, well it's like it's very like honor based.
Right. Like someone being so stiff that they can't bother to bend a knee.
Yeah.
Even though it might save their entire clan or something like that.
Yeah.
Like I'm thinking, do you know the Táin? It's basically an old Irish epic poem.
I might have heard of that one.
Or I should say that I think the actual poem is like the Táin Bo Cuimhinle or something like that, and
yeah.
The Táin is a book that's pulled from that. It has a lot. It kind of. Has the same aura to it of a lot of the stories with Sigurd and the Saga of the Volsungs from the Edda. But I remember reading that, and there's a very long portion where there's this kind of ongoing battle between one of the main characters and I think his brother, and they've become mortal enemies because of like a clash of pride like this, and they go about like terraforming the countryside in their epic battles with each other, and they're slowly killing each other and ridiculous numbers of people, but like they can't bother to like pause for a second and like budge the slightest bit on compromising, and it's like it's their honor that's driving the entire plot of destruction and chaos.
Yeah, you see that kind of stuff in mob movies too.
Yeah, it's a good comparison.
Mob movies have it. The Hatfield McCoy Family Feud kind of stuff had it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've heard like Spaniards have a lot like you know kind of bravado almost.
Okay,
you
know? Interesting.
Like you can't insult them or else they'll just challenge you right there on the street. You know, I don't you know not modern ones, but that might have been a thing at one point. A big warrior culture there, which is kind of cool.
Yeah,
I respect that. You know, I don't know if I would want to live in it, but it's It's interesting. But, nice. You know, in this story, you know, it's not really working for Thorin at all, because any sort of conflict could just be avoided if he would just you know, give us up.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, one other thing that I forgot to mention, the Gathering of the Clouds.
Uh-huh.
In Joseph Pierce's book, they said that might have been, like, reminder of gathering the clans, you know, like, when you're going to go to battle, you know. And, I mean, Thorin's reaching out to his cousin, and the men and elves all got their armies. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like one of those scenes in Braveheart where, like, the clans were getting together.
Right.
And William Wallace was getting popular, and then they were going to go fight the English. It was a cool scene, good music. We'll see.
Uh-huh. Obviously, the first imagery that comes to mind is, like, storm clouds brewing.
Right, yeah, it should be both, though, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
Right, clouds, like, uh-oh, this isn't over, we're still going here.
Something is afoot, and we don't know what it is, but it certainly looks dark, and getting darker.
All right, Clifford, February 11th, 2019. A couple days, the chapter 15 comes out. That's the one where Thorin was a pain in the butt because, you know, he didn't give up the gold after Bard and the Elven King came up, you know. Smaug had just died, you know. Yeah. One of the things that I think we forgot to talk about was kind of when I was editing the Dragon Special episode. Remember how we talked about how Fafnir, he actually used to be a dwarf? Like, I didn't look any details up about that.
Fafnir is the dragon from the Silmarillion.
No, Fafnir is the dragon from the Sigurd versus Fafnir, one of those Anglo-Saxon myths.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna apologize. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so like...
From the Norse, from,
yeah,
the
from
Edda.
Yeah. So we thought that was pretty interesting.
Yes, that was pretty fascinating, because that's... Well, I don't know. It seems to play directly into our story.
Yeah,
because,
like, I think we had even joked in the dragon special, like, well, what if Thorin turns into a dragon, you know? Because now that Smaug dies or something. And it's like, well, actually, that kind of happened. You know, did Thorin become a physical fire-breathing
reptile?
Right, no, but for all intents and purposes, he's acting like a complete dragon as he's under the dragon sickness. Which is interesting.
Correct.
And, you know, that's the whole treasure thing, too. Believe it or not, we've quietly already hit on that in the Silmarillion. But we remember the dragon from the Silmarillion that we talked about in the Dragon Special, who battled Turin.
Right.
What was his name?
Oh, yeah, it's Glaurung. Well, yeah, I remember that he's basically toying around with him. Like, he's...
Well, also, before, when they first meet, Turin had been living at that sea in Nargothrond.
Right.
And then Glaurung and his army took it over, and they took all the captives, including, like, Turin's girlfriend, and the girlfriend ended up dying.
Right.
But Glaurung had piled all the treasure and then just sat on it for probably, like, a decade, I'd guess. Maybe at least a couple years, you know, just completely sitting on it. And after he sat on that treasure was cursed. Like, it was straight up cursed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in The Hobbit here, we've kind of experienced it drives you mad, but is there, like, a spell or some, like, sort of bewitchment on it? You know, it feels like it's bewitched, but is it, like, did Smaug actually say, like, okay, this treasure's a curse or whatnot?
No, we've heard nothing to that extent.
Right, and so, like, as the Silmarillion, when the Silmarillion evolved as a story, so all those stories had, like, they basically, they evolved over... at least 20, probably 40-year period, kind of. And so when he was originally writing that story, he was saying, like, yes, this dragon horde that Glaurung built up at Nargothrond is literally cursed. Like, there's, like, a spell on it. Anybody that gets it is screwed because it's going to end up defeating them. As it progresses, that kind of becomes less and less, and it gets closer to, like, this Hobbit thing where it just kind of influences you. You know, as opposed to it being cursed and functioning as a spell, you know? And that's actually where, if you remember, we talked about this guy, it would have been in the 9th chapter. It was Hurin, who we also talked about in the Dragon Special, because that is whose dad?
Turin.
Yeah, Turin. Okay.
Oh, sweet. Okay, good.
So, because Húrin was captured by Morgoth, and then Morgoth put a curse on all his kids, which is Túrin and his sister, and they end up accidentally getting married because they didn't know that they were brother and sister. And Húrin watched all this, and so he watches all this, and he's, like, really pissed, so which was kind of Morgoth's goal. And so Morgoth is just, like, very cunning, and he just lets Húrin go after that. Because he knows Húrin's extremely bitter because he's seen his kids die and, like, their whole sad lives. He watched their whole sad lives progress. And so then the one of the first things Húrin does is he goes to Nargothrond because he's, well, you know, Túrin was the real one that fought for all this treasure, and he defeated the dragon, so I should get this treasure. So he goes in there, looks for the treasure. There's one claimant to it who he ends up killing, but he's not important. And then he ends up, you know, in the original story, he would have carried all of the treasure, but as the story evolved, he just goes and picks up one especially beautiful piece of the treasure, which is the Nauglamir, which was the necklace of the dwarves.
Right.
And that's the thing that he brings to Thingol in Doriath. And then Thingol has the Silmaril, and he tries to combine it there, and he gets the dwarves to help him. And then Thingol and the dwarves start building it, and then they feud over it, and then they both end up getting both those parties end up getting killed. So you see the curse of a treasure, like, literally playing out in the Silmarillion, and that was in... And again, it was more closer to The Hobbit here, where it's just, like, you know, greedy dragon sickness played out to...
Of an unspecified curse.
Yeah, and it just destroyed anybody that got involved with it, really.
Right.
Yeah. Which
so maybe we have whispers of that here, but hopefully not the full.
Hopefully not. We'll have to see in continuing chapters.
The whole kit and caboodle.
We'll have to see continuing chapters that we have already recorded.
Indeed.
All right, but how was your week for this week? How
was
your
it was
week
good. I saw. On your recommendation, They Shall Not Grow Old over the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
That was the Peter Jackson documentary about World War I to commemorate the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day.
Right.
It was very well done. It was, if you've heard anything about it, it got a lot of acclaim for the extent to which he restored all this old footage. Kind of bringing.
And how did he restore it? Like, what's the big deal?
Well, it's basically, you know, there's all sorts of computer technology nowadays to take the sort of scratchy, old, fuzzy, black and white tape reels and turn it into
of World War One.
Yeah, this is
so
all
those things are 100 years old.
These are all archival. It's archival footage from 100 years ago that was literally filmed by a bunch of guys in the field cranking a video camera by hand. And what's pretty amazing is, like, the film itself is pretty durable. Like, it certain film has, like, you know, the marks of being copied a bunch of times, or it's faded or what have you, but on the whole, this is not like a, like, the film itself is of very high quality because it's film. There's no pixels or anything like that. It's not like it has low resolution. So he and his computer team sat down and were like, okay, let's kind of write some programs to get rid of all the shaking and all of the glitches and all the little scratches.
And every time I watch one of those videos, it always seems like in the black and white version, it always seems like it's like 1.2 speed, you know?
Oh yeah. No, that's part of it. Yeah. So modern, like, we watch things usually at 24 frames per second, I think.
Yeah.
I might be mixing these numbers up. But a lot of that stuff was filmed at, like, 16 frames per second, they assumed. But it turned out that some of them were filmed at, like, 12 frames per second or 13 or 14. So they basically had to go back and adjust one by one, like, take a look at each film and be like, okay, that's... You know, you toggle one frame too fast or one frame too slow, and then they'd figure out, like, you can tell just by looking at it what the just right timing is. So they're able to, you know, get it to a real pace. They did a lot of recoloration of it, or recolorization, whatever you call that.
Yeah, so it was colorized.
It was colorized, which was pretty interesting because Peter Jackson was talking about it, like, you know, he has a maybe a moral opposition to the colorization of films that the director intended to be black and white. But he felt in this scenario that if you went up to every war documentarian from the time and asked them if they wanted color or black and white film, they almost certainly would have opted for color because it's just you get more information. And so he didn't feel like morally questionable in colorizing some of the film. Point being, really impressive restoration of a lot of film, and the whole thing was told just with interviews, clips of World War One veterans speaking, specifically British veterans. And it played through a series of these clips along with their narration or their quotes to depict basically the average experience of a British soldier enlisting and then going into battle. And it's pretty moving, pretty shocking. I mean, obviously very informative, but also really like they didn't have to do very much to hammer the point home, like how brutal and desolate that experience must have been.
I thought the grossest part was when they had all the, like, the rat piles that they had been killing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of gross parts. The gangrene, like trench foot and all that. But, I mean, obviously all the personal toll was pretty terrible. And, like, pictures of dead bodies and everything was pretty rough. But the pictures of these, like, desolated landscapes are basically what comes to mind when I think of Tolkien describing Mordor or these areas around the Lonely Mountain or something where it's like devoid of life is totally what is like the imagery I've got of like these exploded, torn up fields of mud and barbed wire and dead bodies. It's pretty brutal stuff.
All right.
Yeah. So, fascinating movie, but it was it was a tough one.
Definitely recommend it in theaters, but it's probably not out much longer. So when it comes out on Netflix or something, definitely watch that one.
Certainly.
Good one. Anything else? Social media stuff?
Nothing here.
Yeah. Honestly, we're pretty terrible about that. Yeah, it seems like Clifford's been better with Instagram than me with anything on Facebook or Twitter. So follow Instagram as our main priority. I don't know. I'm just not that big on social media. Clifford, you definitely aren't either. I mean,
I'm actually behind on the Instagram. I've got to catch up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, get on it. Yeah. Send us an email if you got any questions. Then again, I think like maybe it's kind of good that, you know, hopefully we're just giving you the tools that you can kind of look this stuff up yourself. Not that we're too lazy to do it, but you know, we're trying to inspire you to read this stuff yourself and not give you every detail ever, you know.
Right.
So yeah. So enjoy. See the movie. Till next time.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, y'all.